Welcome to Keeping It Real with Frankie D, an Italian-American podcast at ItalianAmericanLife.com. And my partner for this series of podcasts on Christopher Columbus, the Paul and Ann Rubino Italian-American Studies Program at Loyola University Chicago, and my partner in these podcasts, and I'm very proud to be partnered with, the Associate Professor and Director of the Paul and Ann Rubino Italian-American Studies Program, Carla Simonini. And our guest today is Dr. Hector Garcia Chavez. And I'd like to give a little bio of Dr. Chavez. He holds a joint appointment in Women's Studies, Gender Studies Program, and the Department of Modern Languages and Literatures, and serves as Director of Loyola's Interdisciplinary Latin America and U.S. Latinx Studies Program. He is a Loyola Sujak Master Teacher and recipient of the prestigious Ignatius Loyola Award for Excellence in Teaching. Dr. Chavez, welcome to the podcast, and we really appreciate your time today.
No, I'm very honored and just excited, you know, to continue these conversations, which have been bubbling for years and years. And now with all that's happening and with the pandemic, I think it's time to sit down and just start listening and sharing how different people view the world.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And this is a great format for it. So, Carla, if you would get us started, please.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Hector, for joining us. I am so happy to be your colleague in the Department of Modern Languages and Literatures. And we've been talking a lot about doing some joint ventures, and this presented our first opportunity.
Well, so this is the first of many, surely. Yeah,
yes, first of many, absolutely. So I'm just, you know, we've been, Frank and I have been talking to people who are, some of them are scholars, some of them are community leaders. Everybody has a different perspective on who Christopher Columbus is and what he represents. So as our final podcast with you in mind, we wanted to give people a sort of an annotated bibliography of the sources that we've looked at and give people the means to look things up and read for yourself. I think that's really the key here. We have too many times I've watched on the news and I see organizations or people, they have a position they want to support. So they go out and find the scholar or the activist or whomever is on their side, and that's who they, you know, put up to establish their position. Whereas I think as educators, we want not to promote one position or another, but to have students become critical thinkers and not, right. Yeah. And not just students, like the community.
Savvy enough to be that, you know, student or that graduate student who then reads two or three different points of view, and they start to form their own perspective, but again, with facts. And also,
absolutely,
that's obviously part of fact, how to put it nicely. Facts are out there, some are more pliable than others, and pop culture is part of that conversation. So with myth making, but some of what we do as educators is absolutely what you said, you know, let's put our thinking caps on and then start sharing after we do some initial research and reading of prime material, primary material, I'm sorry.
Primary material. Well, I'm hoping that maybe you and I could just go back and forth and talk about some of the primary sources and the secondary sources that are available. I'll start with one that I have just read in preparation for these podcasts. And unfortunately, some of these are in other languages, but nonetheless, there are people who speak Spanish and who speak Italian out there in the audience, and I'm sure they can look into this for it. We broke our series down into the Columbus, the historical figure, the history of the holiday, people, activists within the community who have pro and con views on him. And then the final episode we did before this one was about Beyond Columbus. That was sort of looking at, okay, Italian-American community, taking Columbus out of the mix, you know, who are we as a people and why, you know, what does he represent? And if we don't have him, what else are we? So
many million things besides this conversation, obviously.
Yeah. Well, I was really intrigued to read. I've got two books here by the scholar Gabriella Airaldi, who we interviewed, and she is recently retired. She's emeritus at the University of Genoa, and her background, she is does Mediterranean and medieval studies, and she's written extensively on Columbus. I mean, quite a bit. I have just two of her books here, and what I found fascinating about her perspective that we don't hear, or I haven't heard or read in the United States, is her emphasis, obviously on his involvement with the Mediterranean trade before proposing his voyage, and his connection to Genoa in particular, that Genoa was a city-state And these independent city-states were a unique phenomenon to northern Italy, whereas you had other big monarchies growing up elsewhere in Europe, Italy was still divided under different types of rulerships.
And different languages as well.
And different languages. And Genoa was one of these small comuni, which was an independent city-state, and she recognizes him for being a product of that culture, that they were merchants. They were pre-capitalists. They had a view of the world that was very different because of Genoa's geographic position. Right. It was hemmed in very close to the sea because of the mountains behind it, so that they looked outward. And even though Genoa itself wasn't necessarily like a protagonist as its own city-state, the people who came from Genoa were involved in all sorts of explorations and trades, and they were sort of scattered throughout Europe. And that Columbus, first of all, she comes down very heavily on the side that there's no doubt he was from Genoa.
That's a huge debate.
Yeah, but she's pretty strong on that. And she says maybe, you know, he could have been a converted Jew, but even if he were, he still was from Genoa. And she doesn't even think that's possible, only because it wouldn't have been something shameful for him. He had friends who sailed with him who were, you know, converted Jews. And she said, because I don't think he would have hid that if that were the option. But yeah, she's quite firm that she can.
We know them in Spanish, you know, like new Christians, meaning that, you know, their background or their culture, their religion in the 15th century and before hint or not subtly hint that they were not pure Christians.
Absolutely.
Or new Christians.
Absolutely. So she talks about him being kind of like very touchy about his background. I mean, there's the infamous scene where somebody called him the wool merchant and he had their nose cut off in Hispaniola, which is a true history. And she talks about Genoa being a place that had these initial ideas where you weren't necessarily born into a class anymore, that there was a possibility of advancement.
A social class movement.
Right. So I mean, I think that kind of...
The actual Mediterranean movement towards the West, because the East, what we call Oriental, which I know in the US means something completely different, Oriental meaning Middle East from a US perspective, meaning that the Ottoman Empire by 1453 had already, quote, conquered Constantinople, now Istanbul, and they had moved up to what we now know as Bulgaria or even ex-Yugoslavia, meaning that they were inching closer and closer to these kingdoms, to these city-states in what is now Northern Italy.
Yeah, she did talk about that and how that was the impetus behind finding an alternate route.
Correct.
Yeah, she did talk about that. But like I said, I thought it was interesting that this idea of being from a city state, having an idea where this pre-capitalist notion that you could improve your social standing by your inherent worth, you didn't have to just be born into a class. And I think that really speaks strongly to like the character of Columbus that comes across. And I'm not going to be able to find it now. I should have underlined this text in here. I'm going to paraphrase because I'm not going to be able to find
That's
the exact
fine,
words.
Of course.
Yeah. But she basically, one of the things she wrote that I thought was so well stated, she's like, definitely greed. You know, the greed was what might have been the initial one of his factors, but the other factor was curiosity, that there was this, there was an exploring side to him and there was a mercenary side of him. And these two things coexisted in the same person. So anyway, yeah.
Interesting. And I'm curious to hear from the other conversations you've had, has anyone else presented, quote, facts that lead to his birthplace not being in the Mediterranean, say Portugal, for example?
She does a whole review of the different theories in her book and she goes through them one by one, and in her research she locates him within a multi-generational family that had a presence, if not in Genoa precisely, definitely in Liguria, that area there. So
my research has taken me to Barcelona and also to Portugal.
Okay, well tell us about that, because
some of what they in different points of view point to the fact that it's highly, highly possible that he was not of Christian background. There's been studies on how he actually signed his letters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with that symbol, yeah.
That symbol, and it sounds quite convoluted for us, but I guess back in the time that was a means of authorship. Mm-hmm. You know, 15th century, during moments when, you know, pottery, the creation of certain types of art, call them public art and then private art. We can think of John van Eyck as someone who started writing his name, the Ornafili wedding, and again, just authorship, no, autoría, as we say in Spanish. Mm-hmm. So that might be a way for him and others to then identify that the letters he had written were written by him, and or authenticity, meaning that he had his circle of, how to describe it, he had those that were part of his circle, like companionship circle, and others that were probably, as you mentioned before, because of greed, because of honor, because of different factions and different ways that the city-states were growing, specifically in the northern part of the Mediterranean. That signature might prove that he is who he is, and of course he is who he is. What's interesting is that for some, that's key or leads to discussions of how, as you've already mentioned, that it might lead to a maybe cover up might be too severe, but of rethinking or resignifying where he's from, his family lineage. And it might be that his name wasn't even what we call Cristóbal Colón in Spanish. And again, from the research that I've done, it's very interesting because part of the argument there is that if he did become who he became, and we obviously know that he became who he is because of navegación. You're going to have to help me there with how to say that in English. Navigation, I guess.
Navigation, yeah.
Mm-hmm. He's someone that was able to navigate across waters, and obviously the Mediterranean was probably the first large open water that he ventured in. But for those that are saying that he actually had more of a direct contact with the Kingdom of Portugal, now known as the country of Portugal, Portugal was the leading part of Europe, or that part of the world that had made certain types of ships, also had the compass already, and they also had the vision of making it through southern Africa. Well, meeting
around the Horn, yes.
To southern Africa, and then going up to what we now call the Indian Ocean, and then to what we now call, say, the East Indies or Malaysia, Indonesia. So there's other texts that I've read and other points of view that state that he probably learned what it meant to be a, quote, Renaissance thinker, primarily from his contact with the success that the Portuguese crown had even before 1492. They had already, quote, colonized certain islands off the coast of Northwest Africa, pretty close to Morocco, a little north of the Canary Islands, Islas Canarias, which then became a launching pad also for the Catholic kings, no, los Reyes Católicos, but that would be later on. So they were the first to then continue what we now call, you know, this century of exploration, of colonization, and then of empire. So the Portuguese were the first, say, from a Eurocentric standpoint, that established that. So then for some, that means that he was either from the Kingdom of Portugal or knew people who were from the Kingdom of Portugal or were part of that conversation as he connected with other city-states or other important commercial sites. No.
Yes. Yeah. No. Professor Airaldi absolutely tracks that history. She does. In fact, she taught. She is no doubt that he sailed on Portuguese vessels, and he went down and explored the coast. He likely was involved with some of the slave trading missions that went on there. She covers all that history.
Children.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. With different, I believe, two different women, and both have Portuguese background. Yes.
His first wife was Portuguese, and she talks about how, in her analysis, there was this network of people from Genoa that were living around, and he did recognize that Portugal was the center of the navigation. That's who he went to first. And her research shows that it was these, she calls them like a lobby almost, a lobby of these Genoese who took up residence and had been living in Portugal, and they welcomed him in. And she ties this with this idea of your personal merit, that no, he wasn't of noble birth, but he was a commodity in that he had proven himself as an able sailor. And they took him in. He married the daughter of a minor noble, not a major noble. And through this, he got access to the crown, was able to present his thing. So she does a lot with that. And again, she talks about, she sees Genovese that they were all over the place. And the other thing she said is it was typical that they would change their names.
Oh, of course.
When they would move into a new land. So she has a whole list.
The invention of the self.
Yes. Yeah. shows. She has a list of the families, what their names would have been in, you know, Genoa, and how they changed when they moved to different places. So yeah, she does talk about that. It's a great read. I really.
and what took me to see Barcelona after Lisbon.
Yeah, that I didn't. Yeah.
Before Lisboa was the fact that for my PhD, I wrote my PhD thesis, I should say, on Alejo Carpentier, and a book, primarily several books, but this is one of them. It's Concierto Barroco, Baroque Concert, mm-hmm. from the early 1970s. It speaks directly to travel to and from, quote, the old world and the new world. And what I found fascinating as I was digging and wanting to know more from this type of author. So think James Joyce from Cuba, even though he never the Nobel Prize for literature. He should have, but politically speaking, there's a lot to happen. There's a lot to discuss, I'm sorry, was happening after, quote, the success or not of the Cuban Revolution, because he was writing during and after the Cuban Revolution. But going back to the language and how he, again, this is Christopher Columbus, Cristobal Colon, wrote his letters to the Catholic kings, no? Mm-hmm. There's studies here that he actually was mixing, and I'm able to read and understand most of what he writes.
Yeah, I was able to read most of the original text.
I also speak and understand enough Portuguese. I lived in Brazil twice for graduate school. Mm-hmm. So when you read him, and from what these arguments coming from a more of a Portuguese standpoint, is that actually the way that he wrote 15th century Castilian is tinged with Portuguese isms. Mm-hmm. Certain use of verbs, certain prepositions. This would be interesting today to see how someone who speaks Italian and then learns Portuguese or learns Toscano or Siciliano, mm-hmm. and then learns a certain type of Spanish, whether it's Mexico or Chile. And we see how different words are used differently and how time is mentioned or not, the days of the week. All of those little tidbits, people have spent time, years, if not decades, trying to piece together what his first tongue or how many tongues he actually spoke, because the letters are, quote, Castilian, but 15th century Castilian is not modern Spanish or modern Castilian. It's like reading Canterbury Tales in English.
Yes, yeah. And Professor Airaldi talks about that. She finds a lot of Genovese dialect in those writings as well. So it's interesting that perspective, mm-hmm. she brings it out. She lived in Portugal for a long time at that point.
I can imagine, because some of it is so precise, with a word that can mean something to someone and it means something else to someone else. So the way that I ended up in Barcelona and then looking at what was happening there or had been happening there with other scholars is fascinating, because also of language. So before the Portuguese kingdom became what it is known now as pioneers in navigation, and then the Catholic king and queen, Isabella and Fernando, actually the kingdom of Aragon, which is now the big chunk of the kingdom of Aragon, is Catalonia. Mm-hmm. As we all know, you know, especially if you're Catalan, as we all know, Catalan is the language that has been spoken there. Mm-hmm. Leaving aside what's happened in the last 100 years in the civil war in Spain. But what's fascinating is that, and this is what I've heard, not only from a professor that I had, Sergio Corsi.
Professor Corsi, yes.
From the University of Chicago. He and I both studied with him at the University of Chicago. Can't believe I forgot his name. I'm going to put this up in the bibliography, but at the University of Chicago, he's from Sardinia. And what he mentioned to me and what I saw in Barcelona is that the Kingdom of Aragon in the 15th century, again, this is before 1492, probably in the 1480s, 1470s, they also expanded eastward. And they also, quote, colonized and made part of those new lands part of the Kingdom of Aragon, including large chunks of what are now considered to be, quote, Italy, like Sardinia, mm-hmm. and also certain parts of city-states in the south of what is now Italy. Mm-hmm. So this professor, whose name I can't remember right now, at the University of Chicago, now emeritus, he said he spoke, quote, Italian, but he also spoke a dialect of Catalan, because where he's from, peoples had been speaking it since the 15th century. So that opened up my light bulb and said, wait a minute. So he's saying what I've been reading, and he's someone who grew up listening and speaking a language, and then the dominant, quote, Italian, formal Italian, let's say, or academic Italian. So there are all these other studies that possibly Cristobal Colon was maybe not Portuguese, maybe born there, but then spent more time in other parts of the Mediterranean, now Northeast Spain, known as Catalunya. And he then also then adapted, reinvented himself, and Catalan became that language then that became his language, or the language for a time that was the dominant navigation language that sought to expand eastward. And if you do go back to history books and you see where Catalan was spoken in the 15th century and the 16th century, you can go as far east as what is now Greece, which is because of the contact of the boats and the merchants and the movement of goods also in Northern Africa, for obvious reasons.
No, it's just a fast, I mean, so many layers to that that are just so fascinating. I know when I bring my student, when I used to bring my students to Sicily, they're always, you know, we did a lot with the Magna Graecia and the Greek settlements there and also throughout Southern Italy. I know, Frank, you can speak to that too. The dialects today still are at the heart of a big debate in Italy in terms of the standard versus the local dialects. And
Oh, absolutely. And I believe that in Southern Italy, I think they're trying to get away from dialects, that
they were for a while,
young people speaking it, and which I think is a shame, because it's part of their history, it's part of their culture of these regions of Calabria, of Sicily, of Puglia, of Campania, and you shouldn't lose that.
I think there were for a while there, certainly there was a push towards this standardization, and there's been more of an upswing in maintaining your regional identities too, and the dialects having a resurgence. And, you know, there's literature of dialects in Italy that are celebrated too, some really wonderful literature. So
what's fascinating about Italy is that, and I speak about this when I teach here at Loyola and then before at the University of Chicago, is this notion that what we now call nations or republics, país, as we say in Spanish, we believe that they've been here forever and ever. So when I ask students, so how old is Italy? They mention Rome and Romulus. And
thousands of years.
For us Mexicans, it's like stating that Mexico City, which is the oldest continuous inhabited population in the Western Hemisphere, was, quote, founded, much like in a Rome, Romulus, and Remus fashion, in this calendar, our dominant Catholic calendar, Christian calendar, in 1325. But that wasn't Mexico.
Yes.
You see it in the Mexican flag. It's when you see the eagle and you see the eagle perched on a cactus, and I'm giving it a gender now. The eagle, no gender, is a snake. That is where, so legend states that Aslan would be established there, very much like Romulus and Remus and the she-wolf. And that's part of our national symbol as far as the flag and the colors, which we share with Italy. So in a very interesting way, the Mexican flag is older than the Italian flag.
Sure. Well, we had 1861 as the official date of unification. I teach that to my students. I'm like, that was, you know, during the Civil War here in the United States, Italy first came together as a modern nation state. That's a really short history. So.
And it's late compared to other European nations.
Yeah, it was Italy and Greece were the last two of the nation states to form in that area.
It's late even for us Latin Americans and Mexicans specifically. For us, the Wars of Independence started in 1810. And depending where you are in Latin America, but for Mexico, by 1821, we were independent. 1821. So we're going to celebrate next year 200 years, which is, we're a young country, but we have certain parts of what is now the Mexican Republic that can be dated back to 1325 as far as Tenochtitlan. But if you go back to Totomeca, Chichimeca, in the Mayan specifically, or Teotihuacanos, you can go back more than 2,000 years. But it's just fascinating because you think, oh, Mexico is a young country. But if you go back to the indigenous civilizations that were flourishing 2,000 years ago, then you could state, well, quote, Mexico has been around for that long, because that parallelism can be drawn with a country like Italy. The other country that I usually bring up, and students say, well, it's been around for like forever, is Germany. I tell them, you know, as a unified German nation, it's like 1989, the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Oh, well, yeah, if you want, yeah.
Because it was still divided.
Right.
Now, with friends and family that live in Germany, it's very important if they do come from the East, because that means that they were under the Soviet Union or under more of a communist way of thinking of the world, and also how they speak German changes. This is Germany, and you would think, oh, you know, it's 19th century, or it's before, it's Prussia, it's Habsburg, the Austro-Hungarian, in World War I. And again, I'm not a German scholar, but when you think about this, we all three of us are old enough to remember those nights in November of 1989 In our color TV, they were like this big or bigger if you had more money, how they were literally
knocking out the pieces of the wall. I had one of my former students happened to be studying in Italy, and she went to Germany to the wall. It was just total coincidence. She ended up being there the day it came down, and I remember talking to her after getting goosebumps.
That's amazing.
She says, back then we didn't have digital cameras, right? She had a little, she had bought a disposable camera, I think, for it. She goes, I was running around taking my little pictures. And I mean, yeah, just unbelievable. That theme of who you are in identity and how it relates to nationhood.
Slippery slope.
Well, here's the irony that the Italians learned they were Italians after they came to the United States. That's part of our history. They had a strong regional identity. There's a beautiful film. Frank, I don't know if you've seen the film, The Golden Door.
No, I never have.
Nuovo Mondo. Oh my gosh, it's such a beautiful film. It was done by an Italian director. And it was during that period when Italy was first starting to treat its experience as a nation that spawned immigration. Because for a long time, they didn't want to talk about that. That's not the type of history that they wanted to be putting forward. But this young filmmaker did in a neorealistic fashion. He hired local people who weren't actors from Sicily so that they would be speaking the actual dialect. And he dramatized these three family, mother, son, and father, who decide to emigrate to the United States from Sicily. And he did extensive historic research to put it together, beautifully filmed. And one of the scenes that I love to show my students, even if I don't show them the whole film, is they're on the boat. They're in the hole down below getting ready. And one of the guys looks up and says, "My God, I've never been surrounded by so many foreigners." And someone says, "Well, we're all Italian." And he's like, "What's that?" And that was a very accurate representation of, somebody who was from outside of your little, paisano, it was a stranger. And that's the language. That's, so. Anyway.
But I think that happens also even today, when we think of a country that's so large like the United States, do we really know what's happening in Northern Idaho?
Right. Sure.
Do we really know what's happening in the Canadian U.S. border by Maine?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No. Yeah. No. And the same holds true for me. I'm a Northwest Mexican. I don't know what's happening in Chiapas, Milano, and Napoli are both in Italy, but they're so different.
Yeah.
Monterrey in northeastern Mexico is not Puebla, which is a gorgeous colonial city. But again, it's all part of the Mexican creation of what it means to be Mexican and Mexican myth making, much like, I guess, more from a New England standpoint. You think of Philadelphia, you think of Boston, New York before New Amsterdam, but who thinks really of Wyoming?
Yeah. Yeah. Real. Yes.
I mean, they do. They're not invisible to themselves. I remember back in the day when they were saying that Villaraigosa, if I pronounce his last name, was the first, quote, Mexican who was going to be mayor of Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Someone, I think, like raised his hand, put his finger up and said, "I think there were mayors in Los Angeles way before, maybe the way you see the world from an English-speaking perspective, but that part of the world was indigenous and then part of Spain and then part of Mexico and then
part of the United States.
As the party continues."
Yes.
So, and certain people were very disturbed and said, no, we were here first. We are the ones that claimed, we're the ones that brought civilization. And you feel that that type of conversation angle goes back to this idea of civilization and barbarism and how, quote, the Europeans are the pinnacle of civilization. Mm-hmm. And that's also part of the myth-making Eurocentric model that's pretty relevant and prevalent, if I can say
prevalent,
that
correctly. Prevalent, I think, yeah.
In many history.
Yeah. No, it's a fascinating history. I say there's so much room for us to keep going in this direction with our students and elsewhere. I wanted to bring up some of the books that have been, how Columbus, like his historiography, how he's been studied over time. And we looked at this with some of the different scholars. I mean, everybody knows about, I'm going to blank, Washington Irving, I think it was, who wrote the mythologized thing. And, I remember even when I was young, we watching the Bugs Bunny cartoons, like that story was still alive.
I don't know this.
Oh, it's the one that claims that makes the statement that Columbus knew the world was round and everyone else didn't, and that the queen pawned her jewels to furnish his voyage. It was like filled with a lot of fantasy.
Yeah, that's fantasy.
Yeah, but it was around for a long time, like well into the early 20th century. And then after that, this is one of the fundamental texts. This is Samuel Eliot Morison, which he himself was a historian and a sailor. So his view, this is, you know, he calls him Admiral of the Ocean Sea, and it's a very positive representation of Columbus, and it focuses a lot on him as a sailor, because this historian was a sailor himself, and so there's a lot of emphasis on the voyage, what he overcame, you know, the personal qualities that he had to bring to that voyage. And yet Howard Zinn also points out that Morison does recognize that terrible things happened, but he sort of puts a pin on it and puts it aside in favor of the larger narrative that he wants to tell.
It's about the hero narrative.
The hero narrative, right. So that this was a prevalent text. And then, you know, I think of my daughter's generation, they were more when Howard Zinn had the A People's History of the United States. So suddenly you had the history being told by, you know, he says it himself, this is about not the hunter, but the rabbit. Who the hunter's coming after, and you know that put the discourse in another direction. So it's gone. And yet, when you read all these texts like I have been, they go back to some of the same primary sources. So it's you know how you're using the primary sources and what point you are, the emphasis in your vision and how you want to tell the story that I think comes across. I was wondering like what the parallel is maybe with the
very literature. Different. Very different.
Yeah. Okay. That's what I thought. So
different writers. Mm-hmm. One again would be Alejo Carpentier, his novel from 1978, a few years before he passed away. Mm-hmm. El Arpa en la Sombra, which is the one that I had mentioned to you, that didn't finally make it into one of my PhD thesis mm-hmm. chapters. But this novel focuses on how in, I believe, 19th century, Pius IX,
Pope Pio Nono, yes,
wanted to canonize, or
part yes, of yes, there was a big movement to canonize.
Yes, but one of his great vision to create solidarity among quote Catholics around the world was to galvanize people and say, you know, this is again, it's part of the myth making process.
Yeah. Is that you was know, the connection of the two worlds? Yeah,
yes, mm-hmm. San Cristobal Colón, and. Yeah. No, I mean, that's not going to fly. From a post-colonial theory perspective, and what he brings in as well is, you know, he divides the novel into three sections. And, mm-hmm. and one of the sections is actually the spirit of Christopher Columbus kind of eavesdropping or listening in as they debated what to do with him in history. Where is he going to be placed, or what is his purpose in quote world history, specifically from a Latin American perspective? And I mean, I don't. I'm not going to ruin the ending in case you want
to. No, it. I'd love to read it. I'd love to read it. I can do okay reading in Spanish. Don't ask me to speak it, but.
This is known as like neo-Baroque writing. Okay. So think like John Milton, Paradise.
Oh. Okay.
That type of Spanish from mm-hmm. the 20th century, based on colonial mm-hmm. Baroque as well. So think Cervantes. For some, he's not Baroque. The beginning, maybe, but a Renaissance writer. But New Spain, known today as Mexico, has a very rich Baroque architecture, Baroque music, and also Baroque literature. But this would be one of those novels that speaks directly to how his figure, as a historical figure, is a complicated one. Another one would be Memorias del Fuego by the Uruguayan Eduardo Galeano, mm-hmm. who wrote Las Venas Abiertas de America, The Open Veins of Latin America. It celebrated 50 years this year, I believe. It's 50 years this year. And again, he's coming more from the left, mm-hmm. but also speaking to imperialism, colonization, brainwashing, rethinking mm-hmm. of history, revisiting history. But he speaks not very well of Christopher Columbus, and he states, from what I teach in Spanish 272, how Christopher Columbus has no ocean named after him.
That's true, yeah.
He has mm-hmm. He himself probably died as a blind man, not really realizing what, quote, he had achieved. Mm-hmm. His son's legacies and not knowing where he came from, where he was going. So there are all these doubts and uncertainties that pop up during the retelling of his story, mm-hmm. also not knowing where he's buried. There's a huge debate still.
Yes, going. I know.
And his body there was a body exhumed. I'm being diplomatic here. There was a body exhumed from the Cathedral of Sevilla in Southwest Spain in 2006, 2007 to finally end this conversation. There's doubts about his place of birth and his ethnic, racial, religious background. Then there's doubts about his resting place. So from what I've read, the DNA states that his DNA matches others that are known to have been either his sons or family.
So I remember reading about that. They were going to compare the DNA to the people who are his descendants who are still alive in Spain today.
Yes, so he's buried in Sevilla. What's interesting is that the actual Cathedral of Sevilla back in the day was actually a mosque. Like much of Europe, what's here today was there maybe previously, but it's not what we think of it as it is today. And especially in southern Spain with, you know, hundreds and hundreds, 800 years, if not more, of Muslim presence, Al-Andalus. For the Dominicans, as in the República Dominicana, the country that is, you know, shares Hispaniola, quote unquote, with Haiti, some of the fighting is that his body at some point was buried in Santo Domingo, which is the capital, Holy Sunday. And at some point, the body was, you know, not there anymore and then buried in Sevilla. Some claim the body was never moved and that his body is there. So as you can sense, for certain Dominicans, there is pride in knowing and stating he's buried in the Dominican Republic. For others in Latin America, the last thing they want
is for him to be there.
A statue of him. Yeah. Because for many, including someone else that I can refer to, is Rigoberta Menchún Tum, who is a Nobel Prize winner for peace, I believe 1992. I'll make sure I give that in the bibliography. And she states the beginning of the end of the indigenous peoples and civilizations was 1492. I'm paraphrasing what she stated. So it's a very conflicted, complicated history, because maybe Cristóbal Colón, Christopher Columbus, was not the one that brought in all these diseases from the old world, meaning Africa, Asia, and Europe. Think syphilis, pigs, horses, rats, I believe, also. But because of his initial quote-unquote contact discovery, then the navigation and the crossing of the transatlantic trade, which then led to the slave trade, began with him. It's a known fact that he was not the first European to make it to, quote, the New World. Contact in the Northern Hemisphere with Nordic peoples, and I think that's also been documented. But it's established that he's the first one that made it to what is now, say, the Americas, known from a Mediterranean standpoint, i.e. the Portuguese Empire, the Spanish Empire, and then soon thereafter the French, and obviously the English, because the US is a product of English imperialism. The 13 colonies.
So they say that his was the first lasting contact. I'm not putting a label on that, good or bad, but it was the first one that had a lasting impact as opposed to the others that were just periodic or established for a time and discontinued.
And while he was coming and going, the Portuguese crown also was, quote, going to follow suit, because they had been the leaders and now someone else was leading this thing to get to Cipango, which is the name he uses in his letter.
Japan, right? Cipango.
Which is what is China or India or I guess the Philippines these days. And that's how, quote, Brazil was.
It's Portuguese, right?
Because they were going south following the African coast and the winds pushed them west, and they made it to the coast of what is now northeastern Brazil, which if you look at a globe, you feel like it's not that far from Africa, but far enough where it felt that it was, you know, not part of that old world, but the new world. But I want to go back to this idea of statues, because for some countries, even having a statue of Christopher Columbus is scandalous enough. Certain countries like Italy have many statues of Christopher Columbus, from what I've been researching to get ready.
Actually, Gabriela Airaldi would dispute that. She said there are some, but he's not as widely depicted as like an Italian hero.
10, 15, 20, or more than that.
I'm not sure about the absolute number, but certainly the biggest one is in Genoa, which is still considered his city of origin. And then she says there are some, much less. Another interesting fact is there are probably very few, if any, in southern Italy, which is the area where most of the Italians emigrated from. So,
so it complicates that narrative as well.
Yes.
In Mexico City, there are two, and one of them was removed not that long ago. I want to say 5 or 6 days ago. By the mayor, or I guess it's equivalent to mayor, it's a different title there, who's of Jewish background, Scheinenbaum, and it was removed this past weekend as a means
recently
the possibility of revolt and anger by indigenous movement that is very strong in Mexico, as the 12th of October, not seen as the day of discovery, but as the day of the mixture, the day of encounter, but also as what was now known more and more in this neck of the woods as Indigenous Peoples Day, I believe. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of protest. So the statue was moved, which is, imagine being like Magnificent Mile Millennium Park. It's right in the middle. I mean, it's almost like the one that was moved from Grand Park on Roosevelt.
Yeah, it was good. Yeah. So.
What's amazing is that this statue was made in France and commissioned by a very wealthy Mexican in the 1870s. And this predates the statues that are found in Barcelona. In Barcelona, I believe it's the one that, if you've ever been to Barcelona, is the Ramblas. And it's the Port Vell, it's the old Puerto, Puerto Viejo. That was 1888, 1889. Madrid has another, they have Plaza Colón as well, pretty centric in Madrid. It's from 1893, I believe, or 1894. Again, it's a World Expo. So funny enough, it's a country like Mexico that was one of the first to actually have a statue, and a giant statue in the middle of the city, which has now been removed. Much like what's happened here in Chicago. I was at Arrigo Park the weekend that Italian Americans and other allies in Chicago were trying to keep the statue in its location. So it's Loomis near
Oak.
Well, you were there too, Frank, weren't you? Or
I've been there often. I don't know if it was that actual night if you're speaking of.
Yeah,
that it eventually was removed. I was there.
Yeah. But I was there with a very dear friend, Dr. Betsy Hemingway, who's the director of Women's Studies, Gender Studies. And we had finally decided to see each other after months of self-quarantining Little Italy, because there are a lot of restaurants, it's friendly, there are parks, it's open, etc. And we walked into a demonstration, a group of people who were not very happy with what was happening. I had no idea that things were getting very, very tense in Chicago, like they had already been in a city like Portland and Seattle. I didn't realize things were going to turn into looting and the violence. We can talk about that if need be. But then it hit me that there were other statues in Chicago, much like in Madrid or Mexico City or Barcelona. Well, the one in Mexico City, like I said, was removed so it could be cleaned, quote unquote, but, you know, could be politically. But in Chicago, they were removed by the mayor as well as a means to rethink history, Chicago style, but also what it means to be Italian, Chicago style. And the three statues are mainly, I would say, in the south side, because Arrigo Park is southwest, South Grand Park is south, and South Chicago is south-south. It's like 93rd Street. So that's amazing. You think, well, why in those areas of the city? Maybe because 80 years ago, the presence, the Italian presence, was in those neighborhoods, while today they're in different parts of Cook County. So this conversation on just the statues of Christopher Columbus is fascinating, because this year specifically, they're coming down or they're being rethought. So I find that fascinating.
Yeah, there's the ownership too of the statues, which is like that's part of the narrative within the Italian American community. You know, Frank and I have talked about this, that the one in Arrigo Park was originally the statue that was on display at the Columbian Exposition.
Yes.
And it was, you know, warehoused for decades. And, you know, it was a fundraising campaign to let's give him a home. And, you know, so there's this personal attachment too, you know, that, yeah, yeah, that this sense, you know, my grandmother or whoever gave money to bring him here. And it's, you know, when people of modest means put up money to a symbol that they embrace as their belonging, that, you know, their dignity, you know, that's a hard narrative to undo. Yeah, Frank and I've talked about that.
And it's also, it's difficult in a personal sense because, you know, it's 2020. So you had this statue put in the Arrigo Park in 1966.
Right. That was originally erected in 1930-something, right?
Oh, actually, 1893, that particular statue. Mm-hmm. But, you know, just as an Italian-American community of today, of 2020 in Chicago, it's part of our history and it's part of our people from the past. I personally don't have ties to the Taylor Street area, but it's part of our Italian history in Chicago. So, you know, there's that personal side where you're trying to defend and you're trying to hold on to your past, your history from the people before you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right or wrong, it's a part of what has been our Italian American community.
And I see a similarity or parallelism, if you want, with certain Catholic churches around the city of Chicago and outside of Chicago, because certain parishes to this day are known as the Polish Mass at a certain hour. Mm-hmm. It's the Mass for the Mexicans, you know? And it's also, it's meaning Spanish, but there's divisions, you know, there's maybe Spanish for the Colombians. I mean, Mass in Spanish for the Colombians or for the Guatemalans. But I get a sense of that even, I live in the Southwest side and I live a block from a very important Lithuanian Catholic Lithuanian Relief Fund. And I imagine that was established during the, I'm going to call it, occupation of the Baltic countries by the Soviet Union. So this is, it's a block away. It's a gorgeous structure, a huge Lithuanian population that used to live here. Then it became more Polish and now it's more Mexican. But again, that place is very important. And when you walk in, you hear Lithuanian today. Mm-hmm. I go to other parts of the city and even in Pilsen, and you hear Polish Mass still in 2020. So mm-hmm. I imagine for the Italian community, if you follow North Avenue West towards Stone Park, that pride is still there. And then, oh, but we're from the Italian mm-hmm. Taylor community. Oh, we were displaced when UIC became bigger.
Yeah, well, that's a big narrative to still.
Yes, because it's part of, it's a legacy. It's, I guess, the word that I'm trying to use.
Yes, here. It is.
For the Catholic migrants, like the Poles, like the Mexicans, like the Italians.
Yeah, I talk about that in my class too. There's lots of examples and people freaking, you know, why is there the ethnic parish, the Italian ethnic parish is right next door to the, you know, the quote unquote official parish. And, you know, the short answer is because the Italians weren't welcomed, you know? And again, that thing, like many of those parishes that I would think this is true for a lot of the ethnic parishes, the community put up their own money, you know, to construct them. And again, whenever, like I said, humble people who are taking a portion of their savings to erect
huge structures.
Yes, yes, yeah. So, you know, it transcends, you know, the what it is. So I don't know. I think this is a good start. I know one of my colleagues was talking about some of the Columbus statues that are remaining have become teaching centers.
Really?
And scholars are going down and sitting there and talking about, here, this is how this statue was erected. And here's what was going on this time. Here is, you know, and how we can, here's some food for thought about what he represents, you know, his actual history and how it might be interpreted today. And I mean, I think that, you know, that's one means that I think we can work constructively together to.
I think that's fascinating. And also reading his letters. I do invite my students to read his letters. Mm-hmm. I do give like the facsimile of what mm-hmm. we have of his letters and then a quote modern Spanish translation. Mm-hmm. Again, it's like Canterbury Tales. Because it's sometimes difficult, and the H is an F because back in the day,
yeah, how they wrote, I know.
Mosa, all of that fun sociolinguistic. But I tell my students, we're just going to read through two or three pages, and you tell me what you see. Mm-hmm. So the idea of teachings is, let's see what he said. Obviously, he was writing to a certain public that he wanted to keep happy.
Yes.
So that's critical as well. It's the same for film industry now. I mean, films are made for us three. I don't think so. I think they're being, you know, targeted, especially the big blockbuster ones for teenage boys and girls. Well, they're not
right.
Girls anymore. or young men and women who want to see a certain type of cinema coming out of Hollywood. I would argue that the same type of writing technique was being used by someone like Cristobal Colon, who comes from that world where you knew that being in favor, you know, under a certain king or kingdom or queen was very favorable because it meant that the money was going to be.
Yes. Nice. Yeah. No, everything I've read too, it talks about, I mean, he had 10% was going to come back to him. And I mean, certainly there was, and he was worried too. He wanted to make sure he could pay back his investors. That was a very big part of what he was doing there. I'm going to recommend, there's this book that is translated into English. It's a Penguin classic. It was cheap. It's Columbus, Christopher Columbus, The Four Voyages.
Oh, wonderful.
And this is translated. Yeah, it's the letters, and it's also the what his son wrote about him as well. It's a combination. Yeah. It's been put in a chronological order. So this is accessible to anybody. You know, it's in English, and you go back into the time. All those letters are translated here, and there's some footnotes that put it into context for you. I would highly recommend that. And the other thing I read, which I found fascinating, because I had read it cited everywhere, but I hadn't read it myself. I got this out of our own library, which is a fun thing to take a book out of our library during COVID. You get it in a pretty little bag, non-touch contact. And it's Las Casas, History of the Indies.
Oh, Bartolomé de las Casas.
Yes, yes. And it's the longer version. It's very fascinating read there because he had an interesting relationship with Columbus. He tends
Well, then that notion, you know, of course, Christopher Columbus was Catholic. Because of the way that his myth making was built from Fray Bartolomé de las Casas and the Vatican as the center of Catholic hope and counter reformation.
Yes. Yeah.
And you read his letters and you get a sense, no, he's there's a difference. There's a different Christian angle he's taking here, not particularly what we would call now Catholic.
Yeah. Well, and there's the whole other side we haven't even talked about yet with him being wanting to fund the crusade. You know, you were talking about his signature. There's some have interpreted that as, you know, his investment with his name, Christopher, you know, meaning the one who is to deliver. And
light.
Well, yeah, this book gets around a lot. This one is by Carol Delaney. She's a professor of religion and anthropology, and she takes that, with the quest for Jerusalem being his primary motivation. And Professor Airaldi touches on that too. I mean, she recognizes that in his will, he did leave. That's another thing. He did all his banking with Genoa. He left his money back in the Bank of Genoa and all those merchants. And he did fund in his will for a crusade to be carried out. So he had this sense of
that I didn't know.
Yeah, that's another aspect of his history that's very tying him to be his faith. So
this is just one figure.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I mean,
we could go on and on.
Yeah. And like I said, we're running out of time, but I Professor Airaldi, I wanted to say that quote I was trying to paraphrase was, he went east out of greed. He went west out of curiosity. And she has another beautiful thing in here, if I find it, about all the things he was at once, which all sort of contradicted one another, and yet they were all him.
Yeah, I mean, well, I guess some would say that's what it means to be human. I'm curious if you have any questions for me, Frank, directly.
I just have a question maybe for both of you. I'm just out of curiosity. Would you consider him one of the most controversial figures of all time?
What do you think?
One of them.
Yeah.
I mean, like, definitely a figure in the top, I don't know, you know, top 50 of the history of people. Because, you know, this is 2020, and it's amazing that we're not only still talking about him, we're still arguing about him, there's still controversy about him, it's incredible on both sides of everything, from his birth to his religion to his name to just everything. I find it fascinating.
Yeah, from a Mexican perspective, Hernán Cortés would probably be higher still on that list.
Well, sure, because
Hernán Cortés, it follows the legacy, quote, established by the long, you called it a lasting legacy is what you called it before, Carla,
contact. It created the lasting contact. Yeah. It was a result of Columbus's visit that there was a permanent connection, between the two lands,
So then the Kingdom of Portugal and the Kingdom of Castilla and Aragon and the unification of, quote, of what is now Spain as a first modern state for some, Hernán Cortés is part of that conversation. He's the one that made it to Tenochtitlan, the city of gold, in 1519. And by 1521, he and his small group of Spanish European soldiers and other allies, including indigenous, like the Tlaxcaltecas, overthrew this amazing city that rivaled any European city from that generation, from that point, from the 16th century point of view, meaning it was bigger than Sevilla, might have even, as far as population and architecture, rivaled other, quote, European cities or other Middle Eastern cities who had been known as just grandiose and grandeur and all of that. So for us, Hernán Cortés is right there. What is fascinating with Hernán Cortés is that we know that he also had relations with women, indigenous women, and that the birth of these European men with the indigenous women led to, quote, the Mexican. So I am here today as a product of that combination of historical decision-making that dates back almost 500 years ago. It is going to be, because next year is also 1521, which is also independence and the fall of Tenochtitlan and the birth of Mexico City. So he would be even higher up in for the Mexican community. He would be a step above Christopher Columbus.
You know, it's fascinating. So, wow. Anything else, Frank, you want to add? Or
No, that was about it. I want to thank you, Dr. Chavez. I want to thank you, Carla, for putting this all together, because it has just been, we are taping our last episode. I don't know if it's all in the order.
This is the last episode.
Yes, we tape our last episode. I really thought this has just been an incredibly interesting and educational series that I personally have learned so much and I've gained and benefited and grown. So I want to thank you, Carla, for putting this all together.
Yeah, thank
you. Grazie mille.
Thank you. Grazie. Thank you. I'm so thankful for you, Hector, and I look forward to, you know, us doing more together.
Oh, of course. There's so much more. So much more. Yeah.
Thank you. All right.
Thank you to all, and to all our listeners. Hope you enjoyed our series and our episodes, and have a great day. Thank you.